We're very happy to start the second talk today with Frank Frascati from Hampton University, who's going to tell us about tensor networks for critical systems. Frank, please take it away, and the audience, please ask questions as you wish.
Okay, so thanks a lot, Michael. So it's great to be again in this conference. And for I've been to the other versions. This was always great. It's a very pity that we cannot meet live, but I'm sure that we'll have opportunity again to talk to each other in person very, very soon. So this talk that I want to give is a complimentary talk to the one that Marie Carmen gave. So it's actually some quests. So it's more a collection of results in which I want to kind of, in which we are trying to develop a program for simulating critical systems, but also, of course, systems in the continuum. So, of course, if you want to do quantum, you want to simulate quantum field theories or gauge theories, we want to go to the continuum limits. And for this, we need a much better understanding of how do actually these methods, these matrix products, states, mirror, BEPS, how do all these methods scale if you kind of go to a critical point or to the continuum? And it's more of a collection of results in that direction that I want to talk about in this talk. So the overview, I will start with a very short introduction about the entanglement entropy in critical systems. Then I will kind of give examples of simulating critical systems with tensor networks. We'll both kind of talk about matrix Planck states, mirror, BEPS, and if there's time, I will kind of talk about some topological or some categorical kind of obstructions or symmetries in tensor networks for critical systems. Okay, so let's immediately jump into somehow the things that people were interested in like 15 years ago. This is entanglement entropy. So what was kind of studied then or what was realized is that critical systems have a very interesting entanglement structure. And if you calculate the entanglement entropy using things like the Rennie entropy, you see that if you have a one-dimensional system, a 1 plus 1 dCFT, but basically your Rennie entropy scales like logarithm of L, the length of your kind of domain that you're looking at, divided by some length scale in the system. So you get some kind of logarithmic divergences in your if you put this on the lattice or if you put a UV regulator. This is basically how the entanglement will scale in a system. Then, of course, people also looked at what happens in two dimensions. And then in 2D, I'm just highlighting one paper, but there's many, many papers that appeared. The entropy actually satisfies some area law. We call it an area law. But you can also have a critical system in 2D with Poor law decay of correlations, of course, if you have a Fermi surface. And then again, you have this logarithmic divergence in these higher dimensional cases. This is the reason that I'm kind of showing this this slide is that, of course, this is a problem. This should be problematic for tensor networks that basically are low entanglement methods because all the matrix Planck states. So let's see how we can actually simulate these critical systems with tensor networks. So the most successful tensor network method is, and also the very first one, is the one that was invented by Steve White in 92. This DMRG, and it's amazing this DMRG is actually still the state of the art. So Steve White immediately got it right, and nobody basically has been able to really improve on that system for finite systems. So there have been lots of variants and improvements on this when you kind of go to the thermodynamic limit or uniform MPSs, or of course the two-dimensional scalings, but nevertheless the DMRG still stands completely as it is. And in principle, the problem of for simulating a critical system with a matrix product state with the bond dimension D is that somehow this bond dimension puts somehow a cutoff. So there cannot be more entanglement in a matrix product state with bond dimension D than basically log of D. Okay, so therefore, if you would like to simulate a critical theory that has a logarithmic divergence of your kind of entanglement entropy as a function of the system size, it's clear that this D has to scale polynomially, at least polynomially, as a function of the length scale, of the length of the system. So we really need something like a scaling theory if you want to kind of extend this to the thermodynamic limit. So the fact that indeed this area law is only violated in a logarithmic way is a huge blessing, because somehow using basic ideas of quantum information theory can actually prove that indeed the cost will not be more than polynomial. So the bond dimension does not have to grow faster than polynomial in the system size whenever your Renyi entropy scales at most like logarithmic in the system size. So therefore you still have somehow these matrix product states still should give you an exponential kind of speed up, or should break this exponential kind of many body wall if you kind of simulate them with matrix product state. So let's look at a few examples. So let's look at the founding DMRG paper. Steve White immediately looked at a spin 1/2 Heisenberg model, which is a critical system, and he looked at basically the energy, so this E0 minus E0 exact as a function of the bond dimension, and you see that actually the accuracy that he gets is absolutely stunning. So even with somehow the number of states that he kept was like 44, he got a precision of 10 to the minus 6, even for the Heisenberg model. And the Heisenberg model is actually a model that, well, that is critical, has actually a central charge 1, it has lots of entanglement. So there's no problem whatsoever in simulating this, at least to approximate this. But what you'd still need is, of course, something like a scaling method to extrapolate these numbers. And this is something, but as far as I know, the first paper that actually did this was this paper of Nishino, Okunuchi, and Kikuchi in 96, which followed pretty quickly actually on this very first DMRG papers, in which somehow scaling theories were kind of constructed as a function of the correlation length. So what they did is, for example, look at the three-state spots model. So it turns out that this DMRG can as well be done for quantum Hamiltonians as for classical transfer matrices. So can take stat-mech models in 2D and find basically the diagonalize the transfer matrices of these stat-mech models. And this is a problem that is effectively equivalent to finding ground states of quantum Hamiltonians. And that's why Nishino and collaborators, they focused on these classical models because they have some kind of nice features that make it a little bit simpler. And so they were able to indeed kind of come up with some scaling theory as a function of the bond dimension. And they got actually amazing results. So it's like the magnetization as a function of the system size, as a function of the correlation length that they see in the system, and so further. So they were able to kind of extract critical exponents and simulate things like the three-state POTS model. Okay, so of course you can also go to more complicated models. So like we were really interested in what are the limitations of matrix product states? How far you can push this? Are there kind of systems that are really completely impossible? And certainly in the 2D classical stat-mech, a pretty challenging model from the point of view of tensor networks would be somehow the XY model, the 2D XY model with zero magnetic field, because this is like has a whole critical phase. Okay, and then there's a Kosterlitz-Stoneless phase transition. And there's actually a pretty systematic way of writing down the partition function of that XY model exactly as a tensor network. And then you can start calculating and just doing this variational calculation with respect for matrix product states. And basically then as a function of the magnetic field, so these different curves here are basically all when you kind of do the scaling with H getting smaller and smaller, and you can indeed extract the spin stiffness. You can actually pretty correctly identify actually as good as the state of the art where the critical point is. You can also start looking at free boson boundary CFT spectra and so further. So even somehow these systems that are in principle very kind of challenging, they pose no real kind of problems for matrix product state calculations. Okay, so that means that to take this seriously, we need something like a finite size versus or a finite entanglement scaling theory. And this was actually pioneered. I should have included actually the reference here by Luca Tagliacozzo. So I have to apologize that I didn't. So he was certainly the pioneer that actually was asking these questions the first. And the question is indeed what are the right scaling? How can we formulate somehow the right scaling as a function of the bond dimensions and as a function of somehow the system sizes? And for example, these plots here, we look at a tensor network simulation of a critical Ising and a Heisenberg model with periodic boundary conditions. And you see that as long as somehow the system size, so N, the horizontal axis is basically the system size, and all these different curves are simulations with different bond dimensions. And you see that as long as the bond dimension is small enough, the finite size is basically the limiting factor, but then at some point, so you're basically in the finite size scaling regime, but at some point, if the size becomes larger, then it's not anymore the finite size, which is the scaling regime, but you are kind of in the finite entanglement regime. So there's this really crossover between finite size versus finite entanglement scaling kind of ideas. And but then it was possible also to kind of start playing with conformal field theory and kind of, especially in a paper of Frank Polman and collaborators, they were able to identify indeed somehow scaling laws for the correlation length when you're simulating a quantum spin system using a matrix Planck state as a function of the correlation function as a function of the bond dimension. And they found this beautiful kind of exponent kappa, which is related to the central charge. Okay, so nevertheless, it's in some sense there was somehow this works, but it does not kind of completely work completely satisfactory because somehow this correlation length as a function of the bond dimension is not something that is easy to do. And then there was actually a breakthrough paper only 2 years ago by Marek Rams and Lukasz Cincio. I think he was at PI for quite some while, in which they were able to identify somehow new length scales in the NPS formulation. So if you have a matrix product state, so I think most of you are familiar with the matrix product state. So so effectively, what plays the role of somehow the correlation, the correlations are all captured, are all kind of transported via something like a transfer matrix. This transfer matrix is a matrix that with the bra and the cat factor of the local degrees of freedom of your matrix product state, and can be you can associate basically energies to it. Okay, so you can associate lengths in inverse length scales to it, because somehow the largest eigenvalue of that transfer matrix has to be equal to 1. Because this relates to the eigen to the normalization of your state, but then, for example, the second largest eigenvalue of that transfer matrix, relates to the correlation length. Indeed, somehow you can relate this epsilon one exactly to the mass in the system, to one over the correlation length. But then, what they realized is that actually the other eigenvalues, like epsilon one, epsilon two, if you kind of go further, if you kind of increase the bond dimension, they always get closer and closer to each other. And based on some results that we obtained, that a student of mine obtained a paper in 2015, you can actually interpret these eigenvalues as related to somehow the dispersion relation on top of the ground state. So these eigenvalues basically get some information about your dispersion relation, and they kind of realize that the differences between somehow these eigenvalues kind of is a very good regulator. It kind of gives you a very kind of nice length scale in the system that can be used to build up a scaling theory. So it turns out that using somehow this parameter as an extrapolation as opposed to somehow the bond dimension gives you much more precise results. And the reason is, of course, that this length scale is a very physical thing. It has actually a physical meaning. And also, just as the bond dimension, of course, if you take the bond dimension going to infinity, this parameter will always kind of go to zero. So this actually then led somehow my student Bram to construct somehow a scaling hypothesis for matrix product states. Okay, because we are interested in critical systems. We want to see what happens if a system becomes critical, or as I will show later, what happens actually if you simulate something like a critical theory in the continuum. Okay, so then you need kind of a nice scaling kind of theory. And indeed, using this new scaling kind of this entanglement length scale, somehow it was possible to come up with some very nice kind of collapse of all the data. So for example, if you calculate the magnetization, this is like a collapse plots for somehow results that we did for the POTS model. So you basically have the critical temperature, you have this delta, which is related to the bond dimension, and you plot basically your magnetization against it. And then you do all somehow the calculations. So for different bond dimensions, for different temperatures, and you can basically, the nice thing of this collapse plot is that you can combine all these kind of results together. So you can vary the bond dimension, you can vary the temperature, and nevertheless, all these results basically, if you're close enough to the critical point, they basically contain the same information. And the usual way of dealing with scaling in matrix product state calculations was that you kind of take some kind of a values of your temperature, of your parameters, of your Hamiltonian, kind of do the simulations with different bond dimensions, extrapolate extrapolate this result with respect to the different bond dimensions, and then plot somehow these extrapolated results as a function of that kind of that parameter that you vary. So the nice thing of a scaling theory is actually that you can do much better than that. You can actually combine all these results together in one kind of theory. So you don't have to first kind of do many different bond dimensions for one kind of parameter. Now you can basically put all these different calculations that you did for the different parameters all together and kind of make one nice collapse plot. And then the critical temperature and all the critical features and things like the entanglement entropy can then really kind of be obtained in a very kind of straightforward way by kind of fitting somehow the parameters that the free parameters that we have in this kind of scaling laws such that you get a collapse. So this is of course very, very similar to what people do in Monte Carlo and in quantum Monte Carlo. And also somehow this seems to work extremely well for these matrix product states. Okay, so but of course in this conference we are also interested in field theory. So we looked at somehow what happens if you do something like a scaling theory for these matrix product states, but for field theories. So and then somehow there's a complication that is emerging in the sense that if you take you want to simulate a critical theory that is in the continuum, there's basically two small parameters that emerge. So if you of course, so let's kind of take a step back and look at the normal kind of matrix product state calculation. So things like the AKLT model. Okay, so you have a gapped spin system. While the UV scale is one, the IR scale is basically is also finite. So basically, the matrix product state approximation is exact. Okay, so there's no scaling that you have to do. You just kind of do calculations until somehow the results saturate, and you don't have to do any scaling theory. Whenever you have a critical spin system or a gapped quantum field theory or a critical quantum field theory, you will actually have to kind of use a scaling theory. You will have to kind of extrapolate your results that you have. So maybe by the lattice parameter that goes to zero or somehow the distance to the critical point. And especially somehow the simulation of critical QFTs becomes very interesting because there's indeed somehow two different kind of length scales. So there's a UV kind of lambda that goes to infinity. There's the IR kind of cutoff that goes to zero, and both of them kind of give rise to somehow non-trivial divergences. So you have to, so it's a priori not obvious at all how matrix product states would be able to cope with such a situation. And of course, to study this, we look at the simplest kind of theory that has kind of a phase transition in the continuum and a theory that you all know very well, and this is lambda phi to the 4. Okay, so we would like to see how these two scales manifest themselves in the entanglement degrees of freedom. So what you expect is basically a double scaling regime, or somehow there's two different contributions to the entanglement entropy that will kind of emerge. On the one hand, you will have somehow the sequel to one contribution by just going to the continuum, okay? Because you basically start getting somehow a theory of bosons. On the other hand, this is basically due to the UV physics, you expect a sequel to one, but also the IR physics, you kind of expect somehow a sequel to one half kind of contribution. And therefore, somehow, when you study the entanglement entropy as a function of indeed both somehow the distance to the critical point and somehow the lattice parameter, you should be able to kind of see both of these contributions at play. This is exactly what Bram van Hecke did, with a lot of help of Karel van Aquilijn, who is being an expert in quantum and quantum field theory. And so, what he kind of came up with, my student, is indeed somehow a scaling theory. So you have to basically come up with some effective scaling theory, and of course, kind of construct effective parameters alpha a squared, and you have to renormalize these parameters, and you have kind of a few free parameters that you can tune such as to kind of get a collapse. But the difference between the collapse in these kind of plots as opposed to the collapse plots that I showed you for the spin systems, and this is actually a double collapse, okay? Because there's really kind of three parameters that you vary. You vary the distance to the critical point, you vary somehow your, and you vary the bond dimension, and you vary somehow the lattice parameter. So that means that actually to get a collapse kind of plot in one dimension is really kind of a pretty magical thing. It's a double collapse thing. Okay, so this is something that probably people in the quantum somehow in the lattice QCD kind of community must have seen, and also kind of people working with Monte Carlo simulations for continuum theories. Although we have actually have never been able to find in the literature kind of collapse plots of this kind, where you have a double collapse. And indeed, somehow by tuning these parameters, you have like a beautiful collapse plot of your kind of correlation, like as a function of your again of the three parameters. No? So you kind of vary your parameters, and so this delta is basically this delta is of course again somehow this entanglement scale. This A is the lattice parameter, and you vary this kind of quantity. And this is the most interesting plot, actually, the one on the left kind of the one on the left under kind of like the left corner here. So where I plot somehow the entropy as a function of somehow all your parameters. Alpha critical is basically the distance of the critical point. So how did we find this critical point? By of course kind of forcing a collapse of all these kind of functions. So by kind of by fitting somehow all these functions with these parameters C and alpha C, you basically do this until you get a nice collapse, and that basically identifies your critical kind of parameters in the theory. And then you see that indeed somehow to get a collapse for your entropy function, you indeed have to kind of come up with two kind of central charges. Now you have to use the C equal to one, and you have to use basically the C equal to 1/2. And only then will you get a nice collapse of somehow all these kind of all these results. So again, somehow you do simulations with, when you vary three parameters, all these kind of simulations can be kind of collapsed onto one nice curve. And that kind of gives a beautiful indication that indeed somehow, if you go to the continuum limit with these matrix Poiseuille states calculations, you kind of need to indeed kind of take into account these double kind of, both the IR and the UV kind of scales. Of course, using this, we can then compare somehow what the critical point is. What is the kind of point that we get with the best kind of critical point? And this is this compares to lots of work. Actually, this table I took from a very recent and beautiful paper of Delcan and Tilloy, in which they kind of used the GILD TNR, which is another method for simulating kind of field theories. And they actually also kind of did this kind of simulated this lambda phi to the fourth theory using some RG scale. It's called the tensor normalization, kind of tensor network normalization, which is based on the Mera picture. And they were able to kind of identify somehow the critical point up to kind of, well, at least four digits. Well, somehow using these results, this is still preliminary, so these results are actually the ones that my student Bram kind of sent me last week, but he claims that he can get this even down to one order of magnitude smaller. So in that sense, no, the results are like, have already an error bar that are a bit smaller than all the other kind of results. But you see that this seems to be, although this is like the best studied model in critical model probably in quantum field theory, somehow just identifying the location of the critical point, which is of course not a universal kind of quantity, that's why it's a hard thing, is kind of very kind of challenging. And there's lots of recent works that that have tried to kind of identify this, and this is hard. So it's not that Monte Carlo kind of can solve this. If you kind of look at somehow the error bars of Monte Carlo, this is actually pretty large. And this is somehow the results that the GILD TNR and the MPS cut is actually already pretty far somehow from somehow the confidence interval that you get in Monte Carlo. But this is because these are, of course, very hard things. And as far as I can judge somehow, these scaling methods, both from GILD TNR and MPS scaling, are really kind of the ones that can be pushed even much further. Okay, so let's kind of move on to the next kind of question, because somehow people probably in the audience started wondering, especially the people that are at PI that have kind of been overwhelmed by somehow this beautiful Mera. So why do we even bother kind of simulating critical theories with matrix Poiseuille states? Let's immediately do it with the multi-scale entanglement normalization ansatz that indeed Giffre Vidal kind of came up with in 2006. So the multi-scale entanglement realization ansatz was effectively somehow a wave function was the goal of that kind of construction, as far as I could judge, was to find basically the an effective kind of quantum circuit description of how to create critical kind of states or how to represent critical states using a tensor network, or to identify basically the entanglement somehow structure of critical states. And indeed, somehow these MERA consist out of these entanglers and isometries, and it gives you kind of a beautiful hierarchical way of understanding what actually is going on when you do a realization kind of when you do a realization. So it actually allows you to indeed map Hamiltonians at one scale to Hamiltonians at another scale, and the way I kind of see this is that this is kind of really indeed what RG should look like in the Schrödinger picture. And so what Giffrey and collaborators and did, also other kind of groups were able to do this, was to extract kind of scaling exponents as eigenvalues of transfer matrix in scale space to kind of an astonishing kind of precision. Okay, so did this for things like the Ising model and the Potts model, and this is actually an easy way of kind of understanding somehow this once you kind of see the structure somehow the scale structure of these MERA. So nevertheless, there was somehow for me at least still kind of one problem that I could not really kind of understand is that there is still something like a scale here, because the bond dimension that you use for these isometries and for this entanglement is also fixed. So there seems to be still some kind of a scale there that plays the role of a bond dimension in your system. And the question is, what is this? Okay, how can you relate this to? And in a recent paper that was actually building on the work of Patek Shek together with Giffrey and many, many collaborators, we kind of took somehow this thing a little bit, we looked more carefully at this at this problem, and we're able to kind of find some mapping between indeed somehow this bond dimension, this finite bond dimension scaling that you have in the MERA picture with somehow the finite bond dimension that you would need to simulate a thermal state that is critical. Okay, so we have a critical state in one dimension. A critical Hamiltonian in one dimension. And the question is, what is the bond dimension that I need with a matrix product operator to simulate that thermal state? Okay, so this system, although somehow H is certainly kind of gapless, the exponential at finite temperature is not kind of is gapped. Okay, and that's how I somehow indeed this kind of is in the regime of a gapped system. And you can actually approximate that kind of thermal state pretty accurately with a matrix product operator with a certain bond dimension. And it turns out that this bond dimension of the MERA can somehow be understood in many ways as somehow it being equivalent to the bond dimension that you would use to approximate this thermal state as a matrix product operator. Now, this thermal state is actually not living on the physical Hilbert space, but is living in scale space. Okay, so and that's why indeed this is many for people that are familiar with the work of Cardi. This is of course not a surprise because there is indeed this kind of conformal mappings between somehow the real space, and then you can kind of do a mapping to a cylinder to get somehow to get thermal state. So there's this kind of beautiful kind of theory of finite size scaling. Well, if you kind of take this kind of finite size scaling at work, this is exactly what Giffrey and Czech did. They kind of were implementing. They actually demonstrated that this MERA circuit is exactly kind of implementing this conformal mapping such that you can relate ground states in the original kind of dimension to somehow thermal states in the other direction. And so what we did then is actually compare somehow the results or the scaling exponents that you would get using somehow their theory using a matrix product operator. Because if you look at somehow this very special cut, what emerges here in the scale direction is exactly a matrix product state operator. And indeed, somehow, if you would approximate somehow, turns out that the temperature of this thermal state can be related to somehow the branching structure of the MERA. And you can make a prediction, like if you have a branching structure of 3 somehow, this has to kind of scale like 2 pi over a log of 3. This has to be the temperature. You can compare basically the eigenvalues or somehow the scaling exponents that you get using this MPOs or using the MERA, and indeed you get something very, very similar. Okay, so this means that indeed somehow this finite bond dimension scaling can be related, or this finite bond dimension in MERA can certainly be related to somehow something that is that we kind of have a much better understanding of, namely somehow the bond dimension needed to approximate a thermal state. Okay, So the question is now, what do we use for critical systems? Do you want to use MeRA or Metexplorex tests? Well, MeRA is certainly obviously the nicest one conceptually, because it gives you like really kind of the wave function in real space in the Schrödinger picture for somehow these critical systems. But of course, it is very, very costly to optimize. Nevertheless, I expect that somehow there's still lots and lots of room for improvements there, and people will be able to come up with much better ways of optimizing this MeRA. But for the moment, Metexplorex states are much kind of simpler to simulate. And it's clearly the poor man's approach, because Metexplorex states themselves cannot kind of capture critical correlations. But nevertheless, it is easy to come up with some kind of a simple scaling theory. And of course, this is kind of can also be seen as an advantage that that some matrix product states are effectively, if you use a matrix product state with a finite bond dimension to simulate a critical theory, what you effectively do is not simulate that critical theory, but you simulate a critical theory that is that you simulate somehow a theory that to the critical theory to which there has been a relevant operator added. Okay, and this relevant operator can either be, of course, the bond dimension, can be related to the bond dimension, but can as well also be these other parameters. And it's kind of well understood in the Monte Carlo world that this is kind of not necessarily kind of a bug. No? The fact that you have to do the scaling actually allows you to get much more precise results at the critical point. But somehow the jury is certainly still out which one of these two is the best way of simulating kind of critical systems in 1D. Okay, so let's move now to scaling in 2D. So what about PEPs? Okay, so if you have kind of PEPs, this is a picture that actually I think I made used for the first time something like 17 years ago. So I have been able to make good use of this kind of picture. So this is basically the entanglement entropy of a PEP. So if you kind of calculate the entanglement entropy of a region, so you basically trace out everything out. But this block, then the entanglement entropy of this block will scale somehow as the perimeter of that block. Okay, and that means that that's the way it is, and that was the whole goal of introducing PEPs, is that indeed we wanted to have a variational class of wave function that satisfied an area. Now, surprisingly, actually, these PEPs wave functions can accommodate critical decay of correlations already. So you would think maybe there's no scaling theory needed at all, because these systems can already be critical. But that's actually not fair, because the critical power law decay of correlations that can be encoded in these PEPs wave functions is actually kind of really the ones that you can get from a 2 plus 0 dimensional kind of, or a 1 plus 1 D critical theory. This is not somehow the criticality that you expect from somehow a 2 plus 1 dimensional or a 3 dimensional classical theory. Okay, so there is still somehow a need for building a scaling theory for somehow these PEPs. Okay, so let me just kind of start, just as I did in the 1D case, with some kind of nice examples. So we wanted to look at some physical example to see how well somehow we can approximate critical systems. So we took somehow the spin ice. So you just take ice actually at zero temperature, and this is well known to be in a U1 Coulomb phase. So you have actually this beautiful problem that was originally kind of put forward by Pauling, that it was kind of seen kind of experimentally that if you cool ice down all the way to water ice to zero temperature, that there's some residual entropy. So the entropy is not zero. And this can be completely understood as the fact that indeed somehow there's many, many kind of ways in which you can arrange kind of H2O atoms in this kind of crystal structure, this spiracular crystal structure. And somehow the many different ways in which you can do this, because there's this kind of, these red balls are somehow the hydrogen atoms, this blue, the oxygen. And as you see, if you kind of have this tetrahedral structure, there's six different ways in putting somehow these two red balls. And if there's kind of a hydrogen atom close to this one, there cannot be no hydrogen atom close to this one. And so how calculating somehow the residual entropy of ice, which was kind of a problem that people saw experimentally, is therefore kind of related, or Pauling kind of brought it back to somehow, brought it down to a combinatorial problem, asking how many configurations are there with this property. So you can actually kind of find out, write down a very easy kind of tensor network description. So by the way, of course, this is three-dimensional statistical physics, and therefore very equivalent to two-dimensional quantum spin systems. So you can write down basically a papal operator, which is the generalization of an MPO to two dimensions, and you can actually start studying, okay, what is the free energy, and so what you're interested in calculating the free energy, you have to find the eigenvectors of that papal. Okay, and how do you do this? Well, kind of it's a variational problem, just like it's very similar to what you do in 1D, but it's the 2D version of it. In practice, this is a very hard problem. It's, it kind of involves lots of calculations, much harder than 1D. That's why progress is so much slower. But in principle, the conceptual ideas are very, very similar to what happens in 1D. And so we did this, and we calculated, let's say, the residual entropy of ice, and it seems that actually we get somehow something like the best kind of estimate of what this residual entropy is. So Pauling did some mean field approximation. He got 1.5. So you see all this hard work with PEPS is just to get kind of the third digit right. And so something just, well, it's not related to this talk, but what is very nice to these tensor networks is that indeed we can immediately target things like entropies. So in Monte Carlo, it's very, very hard to kind of calculate things that are directly related to the partition function like entropies. It's very easy to calculate relative kind of quantities, but it's very hard to calculate absolute quantities like entropies. And so the way somehow you do this with Monte Carlo simulations is really kind of, you need to have a path where you start from infinite kind of temperature and you kind of cool the system down and integrate your specific heat. And that's how at the end, you basically start estimating somehow these residual entropies. So using kind of tensor networks is really the way to go if somehow you're interested in somehow things like the entropy. But again, so the goal was to understand critical systems. So indeed, you kind of look at the Coulomb phase description, you look at somehow the correlators, and you, there's two different types of critical exponents that you can get. And indeed, you plot these things and you see that indeed somehow you can perfectly well kind of approximate and predict somehow things like the stiffness in these methods. You can also kind of simulate the entanglement spectra. Okay, so then somehow a bit around the same time, there were kind of two separate works of Rader and Loughley and the group of Corpos and Luca Tagliacozzo, in which they also kind of developed some scaling theory for PEPS. Okay, so in the case of Rader and Loughley, they basically studied, let's say, the Ising model, then the XY model, and then the Heisenberg model, as is basically N123 for the ON model. And indeed, they came up with some kind of a very nice way of combining all these results, scaling these results, and they were able to kind of see of put provide lots of evidence that a scaling theory for PEPS is indeed possible. Okay, so this was the work of Corpo. What they did is actually take fermions on a honeycomb lattice that are interacting. They're just kind of interacting on site, and what they said is, and what they show is that indeed there's kind of a very nice kind of collapse of the charge density wave order parameters in these kind of systems. So there's still, as far as I kind of, we think, lots of possible improvements over these methods, because indeed you can combine this with these more advanced scaling methods that I talked about in matrix Borg states. But nevertheless, it's the idea is very clear. Indeed, there is kind of a scaling method possible for somehow these PEPSes, and this has to kind of still be brought to full fruition. Somehow these are somehow the first works on this, and there's still lots of kind of work for improvement. Okay, but the question that probably most people have in the back of their mind is saying, yeah, these systems that kind of you talk about here, these are systems that still obey an area law in 2D. So it's not surprising that actually you can simulate this with PEPS wave functions. So what about kind of systems that actually exhibit a Fermi surface that have kind of a logarithmic violation of the area law? Is this still possible to simulate with a PEPS? Or how will the bond dimension have to scale as a function of somehow the system size, or somehow to get a certain accuracy, or as a function of well, just how does the bond dimension have to scale to get somehow to capture the physics of systems with Fermi surfaces? Okay, so this is some very recent work of Quentin Mortier together with Norbert Schuch and Jutta Hageman. So we looked indeed at these PEPSes, and actually for these, we just looked at the Hamiltonian with a hopping model with free fermions. And why did we use free fermions? Because of course, for this case, you can actually use free fermionic PEPS and kind of go to pretty large bond dimensions. So the bond dimensions we used for this were up to somehow something like 15. So you can easily go to large bond dimensions. And what we kind of did is indeed kind of calculate somehow the energy density as a function of these kind of different bond dimensions. And so what we kind of figured out, so out of these pictures, what you could read is that indeed there's a favorable scaling of the bond dimension as a function of the precision at half filling. So we looked at this model at half filling, and we saw somehow that if you increase the bond dimension, so in this left picture, increasing the bond dimension is kind of going down. This is basically increasing the length of your system. So you take a system with L is the basically the length. It's take a torus. L is the length of somehow the torus. And you see that indeed these results saturate as a function of L if you kind of have a fixed bond dimension. And if you increase the bond dimension, then this thing goes down. And you see this is a logarithmic scale. So this means that indeed you have really a very favorable scaling as a function of the bond dimension. So this is actually a different picture on the right-hand side that kind of this shows you also the bond dimension versus somehow the accuracy. But one kind of particular thing that we saw is that is very important to use Majorana kind of bonds. So you cannot just do this with normal fermion kind of bonds. What you need to include actually in the fermionic description, if you want to simulate systems with Fermi surfaces like this, is that you need to kind of have an odd number of Majorana bonds on either the vertical or the horizontal kind of bonds. Okay, not that this is a problem. We know exactly how to deal with this using PEPSIS, but nevertheless, this is. So, but anyway, the news is certainly very comforting. It means that indeed there will be somehow an efficient scaling, even if you have kind of Fermi surfaces. This should not be form an obstruction, certainly not from the point of view of entanglement theory for kind of approximating with PEPS. But nevertheless, there was something kind of worrying that we needed somehow this half integer kind of bond dimensions. It means that there might actually be some obstructions for doing more complicated systems with Fermi surfaces. And indeed, this is exactly, so if you kind of look at somehow the occupation number of our results that we get when we simulated this, so this would be the Fermi surface of that model that we looked at half filling, you see that basically there are some kind of unphysical points. So for example, if you kind of take some occupation number, depending on how you choose somehow the bond dimensions, there's always like a point that should not be occupied that are occupied or not occupied and that are occupied. And this means that this has actually to do with some topological obstruction for PEPS. It means that actually if I, for example, have this mode occupied and this mode also occupied, this mode occupied somehow, then there's kind of an obstruction for this one not to be occupied. It also has to be occupied. So there's some kind of a Z2 obstruction in somehow the way somehow your Fermi surfaces can look like. And certainly if you kind of go away from half filling, this kind of provides an unsurmountable barrier, and we don't know how to solve this, at least not with free fermions. Okay, so whenever you have kind of a system with a non-trivial Chern number, which is exactly what happens if you add such perturbations, and somehow this is also kind of moving away from half filling somehow, and there turn out to be some kind of obstructions for representing such systems using PEPSIS with the finite bond dimension. And we still don't kind of completely understand the whole structure. But of course, the reason that somehow for this system with the Fermi surface, this was not a problem, is that actually close to this kind of system at half filling, there is a gap system. So there is kind of a possibility of opening, adding a perturbation to the system that opens a gap. And that's exactly what the PEPS does. So if you simulate the PEPS with a finite bond dimension, that should kind of have the exact result should kind of give you a Fermi surface with logarithmic kind of corrections to the entanglement entropy. What the PEPS actually does is simulate a theory that is very close by, but has kind of on which there was a relevant operator kind of added. And this is not possible if you kind of have these systems with non-trivial Chern number, because there does not seem to be any perturbation that opens up a gap. And so this is still something that that has to be investigated, and is certainly one of the big open problems in this kind of whole language of PEPS. How do you deal with systems with non-trivial Chern numbers? A very similar problem is, of course, how do you deal with systems that have kind of chiral edge modes? But I will kind of come back to this later. So anyway, so this I think I have like something like 10 minutes left. So let me kind of go to this very interesting topic of indeed trying to understand somehow these topological obstructions or topological symmetries in tensor networks. How do these things manifest themselves in these systems? So what is this even? How can we actually understand somehow these obstructions for approximating the ground state of a critical theory exactly with the matrix Planck states, or systems with kind of Fermi surfaces exactly with the PEPS, or system with chiral edge modes? What is somehow the obstruction here? And so this is certainly work in progress. So let me kind of focus for the moment on just the critical systems in 1+1D or 2D classical stop-neck kind of problems. Okay, so, Gonlaug's matter physics and quantum field theory is certainly full of no-go theorems for realizing symmetries in gapped systems. No? So, so if you kind of have a unique ground state, there's lots of theorems that tell you, well, if you have these and these symmetries, then either the system has to be critical or somehow the ground state, or you must have the symmetry must be broken. Okay, so there's kind of plenty of theorems like that. You have Cramer's theorem, Lipschitz-Matisse. There's things like the fermion doubling problem that have to do with this. There's things like like the Cramer's one-year duality, of course, that come into play when you study kind of things. And systems exhibiting somehow symmetries of that kind, they're very well protected. So their criticality is kind of typically protected because somehow if you preserve the symmetries related to such kind of objects, then somehow the symmetries really prevent you to kind of add kind of terms that would be relevant. So these are the symmetries that prevent the theory to kind of become gapped. And so we were interested in understanding this abstraction from the point of view of entanglement theory and the point of view from tensor networks, and also kind of to see what happens maybe with somehow the corresponding excitations in such theories. Okay, so let's actually go back to the 1970s, which is, I think, exactly 50 years ago. This actually was an amazing paper of Kalanov and Seva that really is kind of a visionary paper. Somehow everything that happened afterwards in the field of conformal field theories in terms of somehow this whole beautiful formalism of conformal field theories, basically that was anticipated in a very nice way in this paper. One of the beautiful insights that Kalanov and Seva kind of had in this paper, where they basically introduced also operator algebras in the two-dimensional Ising model, is that that there's always kind of an order parameter, but also a dual order parameter. So what they figured out is that there is an order parameter in the symmetric phase of the Ising model. So if you take the classical Ising model in the symmetric phase, well, normally people would assume that there's no order parameter. There's only an order parameter in the symmetry broken phase. But what they said, no, there is actually also an order parameter in the symmetric phase, and it's just an extended object. It's basically a string operator. They call it somehow the disorder operator. So basically it's a string of expectation values. And what they show is that you can deform the string. So it's something like a topological symmetry. And indeed, somehow, if you kind of apply the well-known Cramer's one-year duality kind of argument, you see that actually the order parameter in somehow in the low temperature in the symmetry broken phase, using somehow this Cramer's one-year kind of map, this maps exactly to this disorder operator, which is basically the order parameter in the ordered in the disordered phase, in the symmetric phase. And indeed, this order parameter also kind of goes to zero when you're going to the critical point. But the really interesting thing that they figured out is that this disorder operator and this order parameter, they basically anti-commute. Okay, so these order parameters kind of clearly cannot kind of coexist in a trivial way together, because these two kind of anti-commute. And that means that if you are at the criticality where somehow you are invariant under this Cramer's one-year kind of duality, something very kind of interesting must happen. Okay, because you need somehow, there's new symmetries that will emerge there. Okay, so this is exactly what this topological symmetry is. Okay, so so this is, well, the string of X's and Z's, well, they clearly anti-commute, and somehow, well, they study this in great kind of detail for the Ising model. And then somehow people especially since the year of 2000, somehow people like Jürgen Fuchs, Runkel, Schweiger, but also kind of people in the French community and many, many other people studied this in a very, very kind of careful way. And they realized that this whole formalism that you get by studying somehow this new type of symmetries that you need to accommodate both of those symmetries is actually is given by somehow the field of fusion categories. Okay, so this is, of course, not a surprise. People know that critical systems are related to fusion categories. But they somehow made this very explicit. So I just wanted to kind of show you this in action, exactly what is this kind of symmetry in things like the Ising model. So for people that have not seen this, so there's a very simple way of writing down the partition function of the Ising model in terms of tensor networks. So you take somehow a tensor network, when you kind of start with somehow a tensor like this, which is nothing more than the identity. So if one index, so these indices are all kind of zero or one, and if this index is one and this is zero, then they're all one, and one index is zero, they're all zero. this is actually a GFZ tensor. And then somehow this blue ball is nothing more than encoding somehow the energy of your Ising model. Okay, so then you kind of define a tensor with this kind of blue tensor here as being somehow the product of all these kind of things. Put all of these things next to each other, and this turns out to be the partition, the tensor network formulation of the partition function of the Ising model. So if you kind of look at somehow the Ising model and you look at somehow the typical excitations of type one, so these are just the point-point correlation function. Well, this is just, you change this tensor into something, you change this tensor into something, calculate the correlation function, and you see at criticality, of course, you get your critical behavior. Now, what is the kind of correlation function related to this disorder type? It's actually the opposite. No? So what you kind of do is put somehow an operator here, then a psi string, and this psi string is basically putting all x's in between. And what you see is that this actually exhibits the long-range order in the symmetric phase. So this is this kind of, so it's very similar somehow to, it's just a string that can be moved freely, because it turns out that actually this string is a symmetry of these tensors. So let me kind of show you this in more detail. So if you kind of take this as your tensor of your Ising model, which is nothing more than basically this, you can see that indeed you can move. So if this red string, this is the string that you want to move, this red kind of thing, you define it as being exactly kind of this object, which is a completely trivial object. You can move it freely through the lattice, through these kind of tensors of the Ising model. And therefore, somehow, basically, this defines a matrix product operator, and it turns out that somehow the algebra generated by this matrix product operators is the key in unraveling and understanding somehow these topological symmetries. Okay, so what is this Cramer's Wannier defect line, or what is this kind of line that actually maps one of these operators, somehow these order operators, and the other one? This is exactly this Cramer's Wannier defect line. So it is nothing more than, again, a very similar construction. What I have here is this red with blue is nothing more than a GFZ state, and these blue dots are now Hadamard gates. So this is a matrix product operator that will actually map your Ising model to the dual Ising model. If you kind of pull this through your lattice, you will see that this is only a symmetry if you are at the critical point. Okay, so at the critical point, there's kind of an emerging symmetry that had to be, because we knew at the critical point, you need all these symmetries. You need somehow these dual symmetries that anticommute. So therefore, there's something new that has to emerge. And this is exactly this Cramer-Wannier kind of duality. And so you see that indeed, somehow these matrices, they have kind of this very nice property that that an X operator here will be mapped to Z operators there. Okay, and this can easily be seen somehow. This GFZ tensor has this property that if I apply sigma X's to all the legs, is left invariant. And this Hadamard gate has the property that if I put an X to the left of it, this is equal to putting a ZL to the right of it. And furthermore, this GFZ state has the property that if I put one Z, then I kind of put it anywhere. And with this kind of very simple rules, you can immediately see what somehow this Cramer's Wannier defect will do. So for example, if I take a Hamiltonian, say the quantum Ising Hamiltonian, and I put a ZZ operator here, somehow using these rules of the previous page, I can immediately kind of put this Z there, I can pull it through here. The Z is changed into a sigma X here. Same thing here, this sigma xx is equal to an x. So you see that this cz operator becomes an x operator by the action of this matrix product operator. So it turns out that indeed somehow the zz term is mapped into the x term, and the x term will be mapped into the zz term. Somehow more interestingly is that somehow a local operator in the original theory, namely a z here, if I don't put a zz but just one z, well, you kind of use these rules, and what you see is that this is equivalent to a whole string of x's to the left of it. So it's not just this z kind of is mapped down here, but then you need x's all the way to infinity to kind of get this. And this is indeed why local operators somehow in one picture become non-local in the other one. And this Cramer-Wannier defect is exactly the one that connects somehow these different order parameters with each other. Okay, so indeed, somehow then, it is even possible on the lattice to construct somehow these operators that correspond to these non-trivial kind of new MPOs, these new kind of defect names, namely the sigma strings, and these are actually this kind of operators that are these primary fields that correspond to somehow this this Cramer-Wannier kind of dislocation, or these sigma particles, the Ising kind of anions that behave like Ising anions. So it's possible using somehow the tensor network language to explicitly write down these theories. Okay, so as I already said, these symmetries, so these lines, these matrix product operators, they are kind of symmetries exactly at the critical point, and only there. So that allows you to, in a very simple way, to exactly kind of identify where the critical point is Okay, so the whole kind of business of understanding this this theory is then related to understanding somehow the algebra generated by these matrix product operators. So they form finite-dimensional algebra. They turn out to form representation of the fusion algebra of somehow kind of an input category. And this has been worked out using matrix product state techniques. You can actually come up with some very kind of nice formalism. And it turns out that you can relate all these kind of matrix to possible matrix product operator algebras to exactly somehow all bimodule categories. Okay, so. So again, this is not a surprise at all, because people starting with Witten, but many other kind of people too, Turafiro, Reshteking Turayev, especially also the work of Fuchs, Trunkel, and Schweigert, what this thing that has made very, very explicit in these works, especially since somehow the 90s, is that there's a very strong connection between somehow these topological quantum field theories, modular tensor categories, conformal field theories, topological order, critical spin systems. So there's kind of a whole web of connections there. And these matrix product operators gives you very explicit representations of these kind of what these kind of how these mappings can be done. And these somehow, there's a kind of very recently, together with Jürgen Fuchs and Christoph Schweigert, we kind of worked out somehow the full mathematical kind of background for these matrix product operators. And it turns out that indeed somehow they are in one-to-one correspondence with bimodule categories. Okay? And using somehow this connection, it is now possible to construct somehow partition functions for critical spin systems in 2D, but equivalently also kind of find all possible equivalent PEPS representations for string nets. This was something that was kind of an open question. If you have indeed somehow, this relates certainly to what Marie-Carmen was talking about these gauge theories, but how many different kind of representations, how many different ways are there to gauge? Well, somehow these bimodule categories give you kind of all different ways in which you can start gauging and relating all these different theories to each other. Okay, so as an application somehow, another student kind of can start, he started calculating kind of single characters in objects with very non-trivial kind of geometry. So like this Klein bottle, you can start putting defect lines there and calculate string of characters. This is all kind of very straightforward once you have formulated all of this in terms of these tensor networks. But somehow the really kind of interesting, from the theoretical point of view at least, kind of result is that you can prove that there's no matrix product state that can exhibit matrix product operator symmetries. So that's exactly somehow the statement that we started from. Now, what is the obstruction? Is there an obstruction for somehow a gapped system to have such a matrix product operator symmetry? Well, matrix product operators, somehow using IDs originally developed by Xi Chen and collaborators and Chang and Wen in 13, somehow then generalized to the full kind of matrix product operator algebra case. It is possible to prove that indeed, if you have kind of a matrix product operator symmetry, then somehow a Hamiltonian, then this Hamiltonian cannot have unique ground state. How do you prove this? A unique ground state, well, by showing that a matrix product state, it cannot have any kind of symmetry like that because there's really a topological obstruction for it. Because if it would have, somehow you would be able to express these F symbols, which are the solution of the pentagon equations, as a product of a kind of simple kind of cocycles, and therefore you would not be able to, it would kind of be a trivial kind of cocycle, would be a trivial F symbol. And this, so that gives rise to the Lipschultz-Matthies kind of theorem for MPO symmetries. A very interesting work of Birkan and Gromov, they actually also kind of studied this from the point of view of anionic spin chains. And indeed, they kind of were able to prove that whenever you have such an MPO symmetry, there's no possibility of adding relevant perturbations. So you have to break one of these MPO symmetries, such as to kind of open a gap. And so this is actually very important for studying somehow all these gauge theories or all these string nets or these topological theories, because all these kind of objects appear somehow at the edges of our topological PEPs. So it turns out that exactly the same matrix product operators are responsible for kind of the topological features of these PEPs wave function or of the gauge, of the fact that you can actually simulate gauge theories with non-trivial kind of anions using these PEPs, this PEPs formalism. I think I almost had to stop here, so let me kind of just give an outlook to three dimensions. So it is possible to kind of, and we are working on this, but this is certainly still work in progress, to generalize this whole MPO framework to three dimensions. So instead of kind of having matrix product operators, what you need is membranes. You have to have membranes that you pull through the lattice. This kind of, we call this paper operators. You get kind of fusion rules. You can indeed maybe identify critical points by this enhanced paper symmetries, maybe identify critical exponents. So beautiful work was already done by Clément Delcamp and collaborators on implementing such a program for before, somehow the simple case, or the simpler case, when somehow these paper operators kind of can be related to groups. But the question is, can we do this for general people? So certainly for things like the generalization of the Kramers-Wanier for the Ising, this is possible. It is possible to write down papers. So, but this is very much work in progress, and I would be very interested in discussing this with people during this conference if they're interested. Another kind of challenge is, of course, to go back to this problem with the Fermi that I mentioned at the end of the discussion of Fermi surfaces, is how do you construct chiral topological ordered tensor networks? Okay, so the typical kind of approach in lattice QCD is to go to a higher dimension and study this at the edge. Somehow the edge physics of a higher dimensional kind of object can indeed get these anomalies, and you would be able to get somehow these chiral kind of descriptions. So you want to do the same thing, but we are still not sure exactly how to do this. But I already kind of overdid somehow the hospitality, so I will really stop here. So in summary, I just somehow, the goal of this talk was to give a perspective on how kind of do tensor networks, are they able to kind of go to critical systems? What can they say about critical systems? How is it possible to kind of come up with an entanglement scaling theory? And I think this is all kind of, these are all kind of very important incremental steps into somehow the bigger goal of using tensor networks for simulating field theories that we're really interested in. So thanks a lot for your attention.
Thanks a lot, Frank. Are there any questions from the audience? We do have time.
I have a quick question.
Yes,
please go ahead.
So the entanglement scaling, do you see any fluctuations in the different scales that you probed? Like, did you see any changes? Like, basically, is the scaling invariant?
Well, certainly one of the things that we saw very clearly is this, this was the very beginning of the talk, was also somehow the difference when you do a finite size versus finite entanglement scaling. So if you take somehow a system with n spins and you look somehow at the scaling of the theory as a function of the system size or of the bond dimension, well, there is some kind of a crossover. If the system is pretty small and the bond dimension is very large, you're in the finite size scaling regime. If the bond dimension, if the system is very large and the bond dimension is too small, you're basically you will kind of, if you kind of take the limit of very large systems, you will be in somehow the finite entanglement scaling regimes. And these are two kind of different regimes that you get. Of course, if you kind of immediately simulate systems in thermodynamic limits, as most of the things that I talked about in this talk, you're always in the entanglement scaling regime. You're never somehow in this kind of finite size scaling regime. But I don't know whether this answers your question.
It does. Thanks.
So I see a question that Subir has. So please go ahead, Subir.
Hi, Frank. In your Fermi system, what is the nature of the wave function you're actually studying? Is it just free electrons, or is it?
Yeah, so this was just the one with the Fermi surface.
Yeah.
Yes, so it's basically we just looked at this model here with mu and delta equal to zero at half filling, and it has a Fermi surface, and indeed somehow if you look at the scaling, we are able to capture somehow certainly the physics, but it's a very fragile thing. From the moment you would kind of add perturbations, that would change somehow that. For example, would only, so for example, one thing that we could not do is a Fermi surface that would only kind of be, have something in the middle. So that doesn't touch on the edges here. So if you kind of would only, there's no PEPS wave function that seems to be able to fill only somehow the middle point, with also filling somehow different symmetric points at kind of momentum pi and zero pi and pi pi and pi zero. So there's some kind of a topological obstruction there that if you fill the middle point, you also have to fill somehow some of the outer points that will then be outside of your kind of Fermi surface. So,
okay. I'm fine with that. But this is a variational approach where you have a variational wave function. In this case, the wave function is just pre-Fermi.
Yes. Yes,
can you modify the wave function? I mean, can you modify the wave function to have some, you know, make it more interacting by putting some correlations in it and evaluate expectation value of Hamiltonians?
Yes, that's exactly what we are in the process of doing now. But this is we have not done that yet. Of course, the big advantage of working with somehow PEPSes that are actually themselves V fermions, because it is possible to come up with a bond dimension, like take a PEPS with a certain finite bond dimension, and it's much easier to optimize these wave functions than if you actually, because you can make use of the V fermion kind of nature of them. So, but we are certainly kind of, we don't know yet what will change if somehow we also allow for non V fermi kind of PEPSes. So we know that indeed somehow from the, certainly in the classification of phases of matter, there's a big difference when you kind of add interactions or not. So for example, this E8 classification of spin chains of Kitaev and collaborators, well, this is actually, it's a Z classification if you have free fermions, and then you add interaction and suddenly many kind of phases that are essentially kind of different in the free fermion picture can be adiabatically connected if you add interactions. So we don't exactly know whether the system will be much richer if we add somehow non-free fermi kind of PEPS wave functions. This is something that we certainly don't know, but it's a very good question, of course.
I also wanted to ask something, Frank. Do you know a physics reason why only the MPO can capture these symmetries and the MPS not? From your talk, I got that you can show this mathematically, but is there an underlying physics reason?
Yeah, but in many ways, this MPO, this matrix product operator formalism is something that comes from a dimension higher. It's somehow it's something that emerges very naturally if you kind of study topological theories in two dimensions, 2+1 dimensions. Mm-hmm. And the critical point. Well, I don't know. I'm not an expert in this, but critical theory can always be understood as something that lives off the edge of somehow a higher dimensional topological theory. This is certainly also somehow very much in the spirit of what Witten said and many other people, of course. And that's why there is something higher dimensional as compared to a gap system. So the MPSs themselves, they really live. Well, they can only kind of capture the systems. Well, if you kind of go back to. So if you kind of look at MPSs, they are actually completely restricted to this very first regime, you know. So the gapped spin systems, UV scale is one, and somehow you have some kind of also an IR scale, and then somehow from the moment one of these scales kind of goes to infinity or the other one goes to zero, there's just not enough room somehow in the variational parameters in your MPS to capture that. You will have to kind of do a scaling. So what you have to do is basically perturb your system in such a way that the gap opens such that you can capture it with somehow an MPS.
Yeah. Sounds plausible. Thanks.
Hi, Frank.
Any further questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I have two questions.
Sure.
So first question is about the MPO symmetries. A question about formal properties of these MPO symmetries. So the fact that you can deform them through the lattice means that the MPOs must be in some sense scale invariant.
Yep.
But I understand that there's no natural notion of scale invariance for MPOs, right? So, is there a formal way to capture this or describe in what sense they're scale invariant?
Yes, so the scale invariance is related to the fact that if you define a matrix product operator algebra as being somehow a collection of these sites, the algebra, so you multiply this matrix product operator with each other, should not depend on the system size. So it should be completely independent of the number of tensors that you have here. And this, of course, puts a huge restriction on what is possible, and that's exactly the scale invariance of that matrix product operator. So the algebra, so if I take an MPO and another MPO, and I multiply them with each other, I have to be able to express it as a sum of other MPOs, and this kind of structure factors should be completely independent of the size of this MPO. And this is precisely somehow the reason that there's something topological there and that allows you to connect this to this whole formalism of bimodal categories. It turns out actually that there's also another formulation that is effectively equivalent in terms of weak Hopf algebras. where somehow these structures have been studied also in the mathematical literature for a very long time. So it turns out that these tensor networks give you certainly somehow, from my point of view, what these tensor networks give you, the representation theory of these bimodule categories or of this these weak Hopf algebras.
But can you formally write down a coarse-grained map which leaves these MPOs invariant?
So yeah, the
Can you formally write down a coarse-grained map that leaves these?
Oh yes, sure. Indeed, this exists, and this is actually one of these F symbols will do this. You will see. So, for example, this is a pentagonal equation, and it will kind of map two indices to one. So, if you kind of this three F symbol is exactly the coarse-grained map. So this is somehow the isometry that will allow you to kind of reduce or add number of sites in this MPO. So it's certainly a scale invariant thing, yes.
Right, I see, yeah. And my second question was about your mapping from Mera to a thermal state.
Yes. I feel a bit bad that I couldn't do more justice to the Mera picture, but somehow there was, yeah. So I kind of focused on this particular aspect, namely about the scaling. What does it mean to have a finite dimension, in your Mera?
Yeah, right. So here I understand that you're mapping this pure state, so Mera pure state into a thermal state by computing the reduced density matrix of half the infinite system,
yes.
Right? So this would involve contracting the top mirror and the bottom mirror along half of those indices. And then you throw away the isometries in the other half. So you get an MPO, which you've drawn on the right-hand side, consisting only of the isometries of the original mirror.
Exactly, yes.
Right. So did you try, or do you have a guess about whether you would get a more accurate representation of the thermal state if you made a different cut? So a cut that includes the disentanglers?
Yes, but of course it's hard, no? So the whole point of a Mera is of course that, I mean, not the whole point, but a very important kind of feature of a Mera is the fact that these disentanglers are also to a big extent made such that it would not matter where you kind of take this cut. No? So this disentangler, one big role of these disentanglers is to make your system transaction invariant. So this is one of the mysteries indeed that nobody, as far as I know, has solved in the context of Mera, is understanding indeed how it's possible that you get a transaction invariant system, that you can represent a transaction invariant system using such kind of an ansatz that is not at all transaction invariant. Well, this is somehow the magic of these disentanglers. This is what they are kind of meant to do. They are, and therefore we expect that, well, that's the reason that we say, well, it doesn't matter where you kind of take this cut. And certainly for that one cut, you get somehow this very nice matrix product operator emerging there. So you can relate basically the entanglement structure of the Mera exactly to the entanglement structure of a matrix product operator that simulates somehow a thermal state at something that is related to a temperature related to the branching structure of the Mera. But we have not tried this because of course then if you take another cut, it's not translation invariant at all. It's a bit of a mess to look at this. So in principle, okay, using this formalism, it should be possible to extract the isometries by doing a matrix product operator simulation. So this gives you these isometries. So you can say, okay, I use these isometries now, plug this into a Mera, and then use somehow another kind of optimization in terms of disentanglers to make this transition invariant. So this is certainly something that we plan to do, but we have certainly not been able to make much progress in that respect. But it kind of suggests a different perspective to a Mera, namely saying, well, the key of the isometries is basically the fact that you're simulating a thermal state in somehow scale space. This allows you to find these isometries. And then the disentanglers are meant such as to make sure or to guarantee that this system is actually transition invariant. And we believe that these two requirements would kind of basically uniquely identify the Mera.
Thanks.
Do we have any last question? if not, let me thank on behalf of everybody, Frank.